Thank you, everyone, for joining us for this podcast. I'm excited to talk about diarrhea and fecal incontinence in pregnancy, very important topics, which we often don't learn a lot about in the GI community. And my name is Lauren Fell, and I'm an assistant professor at UMass with a focus on women's health and gastroenterology and liver disease. And I am thrilled to have with me Dr. Aileen Charabati, who's an associate professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. She's also the medical director of the IBD Center at Johns Hopkins Sibley Memorial Hospital in Washington, D.C. She's ACG governor of Washington, D.C., and she's a real thought leader and advocate in women's health and GI and for women in medicine generally. So we're thrilled to have her today. Thank you for joining us.
I'm very excited to be here, Lauren. Thank you for this nice introduction.
Of course. Thank you for joining. So I think we should start with a review. Can you tell us a little bit about how common diarrhea is in pregnancy and what some of the common causes are that we should look out for?
Yeah, when we think about GI symptoms in pregnancy, we often think about the nausea, the vomiting, the reflux, the constipation. I think I had all of them during pregnancy for the first time in my life.
But it's with our patients.
Sorry, this is really when I understood how terrible constipation and reflux are. So we don't typically think about diarrhea, but of course, our patients who are pregnant can also have an acute diarrhea. Often it's infectious, but also during pregnancy, there's often some hormonal changes, maybe a side effect from the prenatal vitamin. And often I see patients who decided to pick up a healthier diet now that they're pregnant. So they're suddenly eating a lot of salads, a lot of fiber, or a milk product because it has calcium in it. And they turns out they are lactose intolerant. So sometimes these things can happen causing diarrhea. And occasionally we have new diarrhea that's persisting, right, for more than 4 weeks. And this is when we have to think about new onset or unmasking of a chronic condition during pregnancy, like inflammatory bowel disease or celiac disease or thyroid disease. And finally, we, you know, you and I see patients with chronic conditions that could cause diarrhea. And so that we still have to manage their diarrhea during pregnancy, whether they have irritable bowel syndrome or celiac or lactose intolerance or bile acid diarrhea. But the thing I want to also point out is that sometimes people might come to you saying, I have diarrhea, but they're actually constipated because of pregnancy. And they are actually having overflow diarrhea and sometimes fecal incontinence. And so it's important to really ask the right question to truly determine if the person in front of you is suffering from diarrhea or constipation with overflow diarrhea.
Absolutely. The importance of a good history. Yes. So that's a great review of some of the acute and chronic causes in pregnancy. Thinking of the acute causes, you mentioned it's common that an infectious cause could be underlying the diarrhea. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the important infectious pathogens to consider in the pregnant population?
Yeah, so similar to the general population, the most common cause of an infectious diarrhea are the viruses like norovirus and bacterial agents. But in a pregnant woman, it's important to keep a high index of suspicion for two organisms, since they can be associated with a high risk of negative outcome during pregnancy. One is C. diff. C. diff infection is associated with a higher risk of complication and mortality in pregnant women. So check for your C. diff. And the second pathogen is Listeria. So we should really keep a high index of suspicion for listeriosis in a pregnant woman who presents with diarrhea and fever or flu-like symptoms, muscle aches. And the thing to remember is that this needs a blood culture to be diagnosed. And it's very important to recognize this because listeriosis has negative outcome for both the mom and the fetus.
Absolutely. Very important and one that we sometimes don't think of in a different population. So that's very helpful. Thank you. So when you have this patient and you've done some workup for etiology, can you talk us through some of the management for the pregnant patient with diarrhea?
So if we're thinking about acute diarrhea, right? So whether this is infectious or, you know, the patient ate something that didn't go well, or it's a vitamin-associated diarrhea or anything more acute, really, I think of it as similar to what I would do for a non-pregnant person, but with really keeping a special focus on one, recognizing the bad pathogen that we talked about and looking for them, but two, really a good, adequate control of the diarrhea and making sure that the pregnant person is hydrated, because we really want to avoid dehydration, which can impact negatively not just mom, but also the fetus. So in terms of rehydration, of course, the ORS are preferred, the oral rehydration solutions. The classic one are the ones that have a glucose, which would accelerate absorption in the jejunum. But what I prefer to use are ORS that contain microbially fermentable starch. That starch, when it gets to the colon, is fermented into short-chain fatty acid, and it stimulates the absorption of sodium and fluid in the colon. So these kind of ORS are superior to the classic one. Now, if a pregnant woman has prolonged diarrhea, severe diarrhea, I really have a very low threshold to bring her in for IV fluid and making sure that she's not getting dehydrated. Of course, we want to avoid food that can exacerbate diarrhea. So we're minimizing fat, fried food, caffeine, if you're not already minimizing that for the reflux. And also minimizing milk product because, you know, when you have an infectious enteritis, this can cause lactase deficiency temporarily. And that deficiency, though, can actually last for a few months after the first infection. You can keep the yogurt in. Yogurt is already, the sugar is already fermented, as we know. It can be actually beneficial for infectious diarrhea. That's what my grandmother says, and I believe everything my grandmother says.
Your grandmother is right.
Data out there. And the other thing also is really ask about and reinforce the fact that we should avoid, sugar-free, fat-free products. All these products can actually exacerbate diarrhea. Now, in terms of anti-diarrhea medication, the preferred one will be the loperamide. So this is the brand name would be Imodium over the counter. We have, you know, a prospective multi-center trial showing that it is not associated with any infant malformation, except maybe lower birth weights. So if we need to use an anti-diarrhea medication, use a loperamide. Some anti-diarrhea medication to avoid or minimize during pregnancy are the difenoxylate with atropine, also known as Lumotil. It's not recommended during pregnancy based on animal studies, as well as bismuth subsalicylate. But this should be avoided during pregnancy, especially in the second and third trimester, because it's hard to control how much of the subsalicylate is being converted to salicylate, which in high dose is associated with fetal adverse events. Finally, the question always comes up whether the patient is pregnant or not, should we use antibiotic? Of course, we should avoid antibiotic if we're dealing with a viral infection or a enterotoxin-producing E. coli, and really save the antibiotic if the patient has severe diarrhea and is hospitalized for it, or if we are suspecting a invasive bacterial infection. In terms of antibiotics, few to avoid or minimize, metronidazole in the first trimester, tetracycline in the last half of pregnancy, and sulfa antibiotic in the first and last semester because of the potential side effects they have on the fetus. Finally, if we're dealing with C. diff, both vancomycin and fidaxomicin are safe during pregnancy. And with listeria, I would engage our colleague in infectious disease to help with the management and the antibiotic use.
Such a helpful review. Thank you so much. And definitely taking notes to make sure that we can treat patients appropriately. And switching, so the paper covered diarrhea also covered fecal incontinence, which is such an important topic because it's one that often people are embarrassed to bring up to doctors or feel, you know, sort of a sense of shame. And that, as we know, is certainly common and happens. And so can you tell us a little bit more about fecal incontinence in pregnancy in terms of the management and potential causes?
Yeah, absolutely. And you actually bring up the most important point, that it's really upon us, the medical team, to ask a patient with diarrhea about urgency and fecal incontinence. Patients are often too embarrassed to discuss this. And we know that urgency and fecal incontinence really affect, you know, a person's daily activities and being able to perform work and what they need to do at home. And fecal incontinence, of course, also can cause physical damage, like such as skin breakdown around the anal area, and as well as emotional and social health distress. So it's very important to ask about it and to address that. So I always ask my patient with diarrhea, are your bowel movement urgent? Do you have to run to the bathroom? Do you have time to get to the bathroom? Do you ever have any accident? And do you have to wear protective pads because you're worried about having an accident? So it's important to open the line of conversation there in a safe space. Now, in terms of fecal incontinence, of course, when we have loose bowel movement, they are often urgent and more difficult to control. additional strain when you're pregnant, there's an increase in the intra-abdominal pressure from the uterus that makes urgency and fecal incontinence more likely to happen. Often, women could have a pre-existing pelvic floor dysfunction from prior pregnancies. Whether they delivered actually vaginally or C-section, it's just the pregnancy itself is enough to stress the pelvic floor and lead to weakening of the pelvic floor and incontinence during subsequent pregnancy. And finally, in the last trimester, I don't know about you, Lauren, but I was big and it was hard to move around. I can only imagine having to run to the bathroom. I probably, you know, I would not make it if I have diarrhea. So all these factors play in the fact that urgency and fecal incontinence can be worse during pregnancy in the context of diarrhea. Now, of course, we do have patients that also have other conditions that increase the risk of incontinence, even in the absence of diarrhea, such as having prior anorectal surgeries, patients with IBD or non-IBD who had the totocolectomy with a pouch, ileal pouch, anastomosis. These patients are also at high risk of fecal incontinence during pregnancy.
Absolutely. That's a very helpful review of all the different potential contributions. And one of the recommended treatments in the article is pelvic floor physical therapy. And I'm hoping to get some practical tips from you because even in Massachusetts, it can be hard for my patients to access pelvic floor physical therapy that's covered with insurance. And so there can be cost issues and just a limited supply of pelvic floor physical therapists. So have you found any resources online that are useful or disseminatable for people in rural communities or with insurance or cost issues?
Yeah, absolutely. So I often refer my patient to physical therapy who have a focus on pelvic floor therapy. But even when I do that, I always actually direct them to the Mayo Clinic website. I really like the way they outline how to do the Kegel exercise, when to do it, how to perfect it. So I really like that. And then it's important to talk about it. And in order to talk about it, it's important for us to know how to do it. So I review things with my gynecologist and the pelvic floor team so I can guide patients. And then we can kind of reinforce that during the visit and encourage them to keep doing that. So Kegel exercises are very important. And again, you know, I like the Mayo Clinic website. I don't know what you have used. I would love to hear what you've used, Lauren. But I also recommend adding psyllium. And there's good data showing that it does decrease the risk of fecal incontinence in non-pregnant patients. So I'm assuming it also helps with pregnant patients. And just start slow and like around 5 grams a day and then increase it until you are able to achieve a better consistency of the stool and that can help prevent fecal incontinence.
Oh, that's great. Yes, absolutely. Those bulking agents can be very helpful. And the pelvic floor physical therapy tip that it's on the Mayo Clinic, I'm glad to hear that. And I think it's also great, a good important tip that we should all be reviewing that ourselves so we can sort of walk patients through that at a clinic visit, because it's, you know, saying you should do some Kegel exercises isn't as helpful as being able to do.
Even in our training, you and I don't think we had a good understanding what a Kegel exercise was until we had to use it. So it's important to really understand what it means. And then the other thing I want to point out, you know, there are other things we usually use in our practice for chronic diarrhea or incontinence, and maybe patients are already on it before they get pregnant, and that I want to kind of point out that they might not all be very adequate to use during pregnancy.
Are there any medications for the patients who this is not a new symptom for them? So they have come into pregnancy already suffering from diarrhea beforehand. They have IBS-D or they have bile acid diarrhea. Are there medications that they might have been taking before their pregnancy that we should now recommend that they stop now that they're pregnant?
Yeah, this is a great question. There are a lot of common medications that we use to manage diarrhea and manage fecal incontinence that we should be more cautious of during pregnancy. For example, bile acid sequestration, such as colestipol and cholestyramine, these can interfere with the absorption of fat-soluble vitamins, such as vitamin K, and that can lead to coagulopathy in the mom. And the regular prenatal supplementation that we typically give pregnant women might not be adequate. And so these women on bile sequestration should be monitored for vitamin deficiency and need a better supplementation during pregnancy. The second medication I think of that I actually often use in my patient with severe IBS diarrhea is alosetron or Lotronex. So we have good data showing that it's safe to be used during pregnancy. So if the patient is already on it, we don't need to stop it. But I don't start it during pregnancy because, as we know, Lotrinex can be associated with the risk of ischemic colitis or severe constipation. And this is not something we want to happen in our pregnant patient. And finally, rifaximin or Xifaxan, often used for traveler's diarrhea or IBS diarrhea. It's, it's interesting. You know, the recommendation is to avoid in the first trimester. Now, this is based on animal study, pregnant rats and rabbits. It's been shown to cause malformation at a higher than normal dose. Now, in theory, rifaximin is not absorbed by the gut and should be safe for the fetus. But in the context of these animal studies and the fact that we don't have human pregnancy studies, it's best to avoid in the first trimester. So these are the general things that I keep in mind as reviewing medication for patients who are on these medications chronically and planning to get pregnant, or they are pregnant and I'm thinking, what is the best way to control the diarrhea and the fecal incontinence? These are a few things that I try to avoid.
Those are great pearls, especially because we know that that about 50% of pregnancies in the U.S. are unplanned. So when you're prescribing these medications to a woman of reproductive age, even if you have not discussed pregnancy, you should probably be asking about family planning and be, you know, asking about, you know, birth control status, or at least letting them know that that some of these are contraindicated.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We often think about, you know, asking these questions in women on biologic and, you know, medication that people worry about. But we often forget that sometimes the simpler medication can also have potential side effects to our patients when they're pregnant.
Thank you so much for all of your helpful information. So this actually may not have been studied empirically, but I'm curious, in your experience, does fecal incontinence that starts during pregnancy portend ongoing incontinence issues postpartum? So should we have to warn individuals who are experiencing this that they might have ongoing symptoms after pregnancy?
Yeah, so this is a great question, actually. And, you know, when we were writing the article, I tried to find some data. And unfortunately, like it often happens with women health, there's very little data out there. It's a little bit like when they tell you you have a hemorrhoid during pregnancy and they will disappear afterward. And we all know they won't, because nobody actually, these books were written by men probably who never got pregnant. But the reassuring thing is that most women, in my experience, retain bowel control after pregnancy if they had fecal incontinence during pregnancy. However, it really depends on certain circumstances, and some women may continue to suffer from incontinence after pregnancy. So again, this is due to the pressure on the pelvic floor and maybe damage to the muscle and the nerve during labor and delivery, especially if it was a traumatic delivery, if there were, episiotomy. All this can further damage the muscle and the nerve responsible for the bowel control, and that can lead to incontinence. There is some data that there are certain factors that can increase the risk of having persistent incontinence after pregnancy. Being an older mom, you know, our muscle maybe are not as strong and vibrant, and maybe don't bounce back as quickly. Obesity, again, because probably the pressure on the pelvic floor, having a larger baby and having a longer labor or traumatic delivery. So if you have a patient who had fecal incontinence during pregnancy, and even more so if they've had, you know, these risk factors, then it's very important to discuss this with the patient so that the patient know what to expect, and really then reinforce the importance of Kegel exercise, having a regular bathroom schedule so that to avoid these time of urgency and incontinence. And of course, if this becomes a more chronic issue that cannot be controlled with simple measure, then really consider more sophisticated therapies like biofeedback or nerve stimulation, you know, surgical repair of muscle damage, et cetera.
Absolutely. That's such a great point. And it brings us back to our earlier, you know, normalize it by asking patients about it, because it might not be something they want to volunteer. But patients, especially patients who've had multiple pregnancies, multiple deliveries, you should be asking about urgency and incontinence for their pelvic floor.
Absolutely. And sometimes the patient is not sure if they should ask a gynecologist or the gastroenterologist, and they're embarrassed by both. So it's really important to open the lines of communication on that.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for that wisdom and for helping spread the important content of the article.
Well, thank you so much for having me. That was fun.